Today, Blake Bettner returns to the show to chat watches, F1, and his new business, The Deep Track. I'm excited to share everything he has in store for his new project, the processes for his approach to writing and video, and we even delve into parenthood. Please enjoy my fun catch-up with Blake Bettner. I'm your host, Wesley Smith, and you're listening to the Standard H Podcast. Mr. Blake Bettner.
What's up, dude? Good to see you, man.
Good to see you. How are you?
Good. Keeping busy. I just finished recording a different podcast with somebody else for next week, talking all about Watches and Wonders, which is coming up in about a month. So all that stuff on my mind now.
We're going to talk about that here, too. So hopefully it's not old news.
I'm ready to talk about whatever you want to talk about, man.
No, man, I love it. So is that for your show, or you were a guest on another show?
No, that was for mine. I had another journalist here in New York who covers the watch industry on, Kate Bazemore.
Okay.
And we just talked about like kind of some trends in the industry and what we expect we might see and Watches and Wonders and all that kind of stuff. So yeah, I got all that stuff like on my mind.
Nice. Okay, so what's your hot take? If you narrow it to 1 to 3, like who's doing what?
Oh man, let's see here. Maybe Kate had I give her entirely credit for this. She mentioned there was some anniversary for CERN, the particle accelerator in Geneva was coming up, and that there could potentially be some like Milgauss connection there for Rolex doing a new Milgauss, and then everything started to click. I was like, oh yes, I would love to see this. Because the Milgauss is like the last one of the modern Rolex is it hasn't received the new movement upgrade, the 32 series movements. So, a new, maybe titanium Milgauss with the new movement, I'm on board.
Wow. Okay. What color's the seconds hand?
Oh boy. It's gotta be orange, right? Or red.
Yeah. I was thinking, would they go back to red? Do you think?
Yeah, I would like to see that. As long as they do something fun with the seconds hand, like that's all I want to. That's all I want to see. But I think potentially more realistically, more use of titanium. I can't imagine they just bring out the Yachtmaster in titanium and leave it at that. Like they've got to have a plan with that. And I would love to see it in the Explorer 2 collection. Mm-hmm. If they're not going to bring it back down to its 40 millimeter size, then make it in titanium. Maybe also seeing titanium in the Sea Dweller collection, I think, would also make a lot of sense.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think we'll see it in like the Sub or the Daytona collection or anything like that, like just yet.
Do you think the 41, 42 millimeter size, or 43, I guess, in the case of the Sea Dweller, do you think those are size related, not just for pressure rating and such, but like the Explorer 2, for example? Is it movement related? Is the movement just larger?
No, because it's the same movement that's in like the 12671Os.
Oh, it is. Okay.
GMTs.
Okay.
So it's, I think they were kind of like catching on to the, some of the sizing trends going up. But I also think they did it with the Explorer 2 to kind of differentiate it from the Submariner and the GMT, which are all kind of on the same platform.
Right. Right.
You know, now like that's its own thing. And, you know, and they kind of lean into it as like, look, the Explorer 2 is this kind of hardcore tool watch. You know, there's no polished surfaces or anything like that. It's meant for this, so they're just going to lean further into it. You know, whereas like the 5-digit Explorer 2 was like a great everyday approachable, and it still is, a watch to wear. You know, the current one is maybe like a bit much for some wrists, but like there's no denying it's like an impressive bit of kit. You know,
yeah, totally. Little known fact, my first favorite Rolex was the Milgauss Black Dial Green Glass.
Nice. But okay, never, Black Dial Green Glass. Yeah.
Yeah, never owned it. Fell in love with it at Century City Mall in LA. I'll never forget. I called my dad and I was like, "Dad, I think I found a really cool watch." And he's like, "Well, what is it?" I was like, "It's called the Milgauss." And he goes, "Well, how much is it?" And I think at the time it was either 7,000 or 7,400, something like that. And he goes, "Oh, that's all? Let's get two." And I was like,
that's a good dad response, right?
Yeah. And
But but you've never owned one.
I've never owned one. I still like it a lot. I just, by the time it came time to get my first, it was the OP36 Black Dial that I wore for my wedding. And, you know, I just wanted something more of like a timeless size, I guess, at the 36, because I think that one was 40, right? If I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, and there's something else about the MilGauss that a lot of people don't realize, and that's just how tanky the case is.
Yeah, it's heavy. Yeah.
It's a thick case. I think and not to get like too far down in the weeds, but when they updated the Air King last year with a new case, it's a fantastic case.
Yeah.
And so I know most people see the, you know, they altered the dial a little bit. They gave the five a zero, but the case, I think, is the real story of that
Yeah.
watch. And that is I believe at the moment the only watch that uses that case. So I there's no, and that's such an obscure watch. So I can't imagine they made a whole case just for that
Right.
reference. So I would also put money that we will see that case used somewhere else, and I hope we do because it's an exceptional case.
Okay, Watches and Wonders obviously goes far beyond Rolex. So what else is on your mind? We're both IWC heads, and we'll get to that a little bit later as well. So what's IWC in your brain gonna
Well,
do?
I can't delve into that territory because I've already had a preview with IWC
Oh, snap.
about what is coming. So I could feign ignorance and say what I, you know, well, I
Yeah.
hope I see this, but
Yeah.
I don't want to be like too disingenuous about.
All good. All
All I'll
good.
say is, like I would like to see at some point in the future from IWC, a new aqua timer that maybe goes back to some of the like GST style case. I'm not saying that's what's coming this year. I would like to see that from them.
Yeah, okay, cool. So that just means that's not coming this year. So that's fine.
Well, I yeah. Maybe I haven't seen everything.
Right. Gotcha.
No. But other than that, there are definitely brands on my mind that I think about, and one that I've been thinking. I feel like I go into every year almost thinking about this brand. In the last few years, I haven't really seen like what I wanted to see, even though they do cool stuff, and that's Jaeger-LeCoultre.
Sure.
So JLC, they do. Of course, they have a great history. They make amazing movements. I feel like they've really kind of leaned into the higher end of things over the last few years, doing some like ultra complicated type stuff. But they have a great dive watch heritage. Love to see them bring back in a more interesting way than the current Mumblebox.
Well, so, I wanted to ask you about this later, and because we're going to get maybe a little bit more into the weeds as far as what you're doing now and with Deep Track, what does Watches and Wonders literally look like for you? Are you going? Are you staying in New York? Like, how are you broadcasting? Like what is this going to look like for you?
So I will be there full week on the ground, and I have about 30 meetings with brands.
Amazing.
So I will have, you know, a tripod, a camera, and some mics, and I'll be creating content on the fly there and reacting to what I'm seeing. So, and I'll probably do a few special episodes of the podcast, maybe like short form that I do. It's a tough thing to do, especially by yourself, because you know you're trying to take in everything, which is tough for a few reasons because you're seeing a lot of new watches. So it's hard to like fully process in an intelligent way everything that I'm seeing. You know, my knowledge goes deep in a few particular areas. So in those areas, I can look at the new watches and immediately something interesting, useful to say. Not that I need a little time to digest and to do a little more research, maybe talk to other people. To kind of to gather things. So and that is balanced against like trying to be at all the I can be at in the evenings to talk to people and manage ships. And you know, there's a lot of colleagues from you know this world that I don't get to see all that often that I do see at this event. Like from all the Dutch publications like RJ and Frank and those guys. Or Andrew McCutcheon, or Adrian, you know, all these guys that I don't get to see all that often. It's nice to be able to catch up with them there. So, with all the little time left, like that's when you have to try to, you know, actually make something meaningful together to put on social media or put on the website or upload to YouTube, all that kind of stuff. So, you know, I've done though, going back to Basel days with just me and one other person, but I've never done it solo before. So I think I can do that ultimately where I want to invest most of my time, which is something that I'll know and see everything that that is coming out, you know.
Yeah, I look, man. I mean, obviously, I can empathize for being the one man band. I think it's one of those things too, where like when you're thinking of content, you're thinking of video, you're thinking of photos, and then for you're also thinking journalism, you're thinking writing, word choice, like let alone what your eyes are seeing. You know, you're also just like processing like everything that's going on, and I'd imagine it's sort of like, not only just information overload, but sort of just like just the senses, right? It's the sound, it's the it's I
Yeah,
get it, man.
there's a
It's
lot of
gonna be a
that.
lot. Yeah. You know, it's like me being on vacation and being like, oh shit, I should have brought my camera to this spot because I just saw something really cool and now I don't have my camera on me, you know? Granted, we have iPhone or whatever, but yeah. Well, that's really cool. I'm stoked for you that you're gonna be able to get to go.
Yeah, thanks, Ben.
The hotels are exorbitant. so I get it. I get it. You know, it's an investment, quite literally.
So it's the if it, getting an official invite as press comes with the hotel 5 nights of one of the of one of a couple of hotels that they get. But the flights, well, I should say for me, it's not like I'm some important big shot, but I, you know, there are people that I think are flown out and put up and all that kind of stuff. But the hotel, I do have covered as a member of the press, so I'm
Oh, that's
exceedingly
great.
grateful for that.
Oh, that's cool. So how does that work then? Does the Watches and Wonders itself pays the hotel for press?
So actually, all of the brands do together.
Oh, cool.
Like the members of the press that it invites, as I understand it, and I hope it's okay that I talk about this. I don't know if this is some secret, but it's all the attending brands will make approvals of the lists of journalists put forth, and then that's once that final list happens, all the brands chip in to pick up the hotel blocks
Oh, cool.
for the press attendees. Yeah.
Nice. Well, there's other news that we have to cover, involving a prancing horse in a red car and a Brit. What's your two cents on Lewis going to Ferrari?
I'm happy for him. And I think that, you know, he has nothing left to prove, obviously. So this feels like kind of
Swan song.
yeah, like he wants the experience of being in a bar, you know, and if he can pick shoes, then why not? So I'm happy for him, and you know, it's ironic. I mean, you see the cars looking like so far that we've had one practice session under our belts. The car looks quite strong this year, like it might be in fighting shape. So you know, part of you wonders is he going to be wishing that he had made that move sooner rather than later? But it sounds like he's taking a multi-year approach to this. Like he wants to stick it out, maybe even into the new regulation era, to see how it goes. So he still seems to be fighting at the top of his game, though. You know, like he can hang. Look at like him and Fernando. It's incredible what they're doing. So I want him to be where it feels like he's A, happy mentally, and then B, can you know, have the best chance at putting his talents to best use.
Yeah.
All I want of it at the end of the day, though, is more competitive racing at the front of the field. So if he's
Yeah.
able to do that in Ferrari, then great.
You know, it's funny you said that about wishing he may have wanted to go earlier, sooner. It sort of harkens back to something I've said on the podcast before in a somewhat conjecture like theory that I had years ago. I think is what 2021 when he lost to Max in that controversial ending, right? And my theory was is he knew he wasn't going to be competitive in the updated regulation the following year in 2022. And him knowing that only pissed him off even more because he knew that it probably, again, this is just a theory, you know? And I wonder if there's some version of that with the Ferrari versus Mercedes next year where he might know something we don't, and he's super stoked to go to Ferrari potentially. And then, you know, I don't know. And then you kind of go down the rabbit hole of like the politics, right? Because everybody will tell you, Kimi Räikkönen will be the first to tell you that it's very political within Formula One, you know? And so, like, I just wonder what the politics are as well, you know?
Yeah, I would not be surprised if that played a large part in it. Of course, Mercedes have signed one of the best up-and-coming talents in Formula 2 and Kimi Antonelli there. So I think, you know, this avoids a messy situation for Mercedes to bring him up in a way that will not piss off any of their A drivers or anything like that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they need a seat warmer next year, or if he's able to accumulate the super points that he needs towards his license, I don't know. But yeah, this does feel like it's maybe this is the scenario that is the path of least resistance for everyone involved.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. Totally. You mentioned the cars looking strong. What is your favorite livery this year?
I think that the Ferrari car looks fantastic.
Yeah, I agree.
I like the elements of white that have been added, as well as the yellow. The Ferrari car looks just beautiful, as usually as I, you know, to be perfect. The Aston Martin always looks good. I think that's a you know, the green wears really beautifully on that car. I'm not as enamored with the Visa Cash App Racing Bull livery as everyone else seems to be. That maybe is not my like favorite. It kind of looks like a giant credit card to me. But boy, that car looks pretty strong too. but no, I think the Ferrari is probably at the top of the heap when it comes to that. I think the striping, the white and the yellow looks just fantastic. It looks like a proper race car.
Yeah, when I heard the Visa Cash App, what, you know, that whole thing, it just reminded me for you golfers out there of the Konica Minolta Swing Biz Hub camera that slows down a golf swing during the CBS recordings, which is just when he has to spit out that gobbledygook of a combination of words, I'm just always like, holy smokes, marketing is out of control at this moment.
Yes, it has to be stopped, right? Like, it's ridiculous.
Do we just call this the Visa car? Like, what are we going to call it?
I've heard a few things. What is it? The Racing Bulls, or okay. RB, mm-hmm. which I think is their preference, RB, or yeah, a V-carb. V-carb.
Okay.
Which is maybe a little more palatable.
Yeah.
I suppose.
It's unbelievable, man. Okay, well, cool. Well, I definitely obviously want to talk about deep track, but and by the way, for those who are the uninitiated, Blake has been on the show once before. So if you haven't heard that, go back and listen to our conversation previously. I don't remember if I did not do my homework. I did not listen to our episode from before. Did I ask you, what was your first watch?
You may have my first. So I have. It's a tricky question to answer because I have pictures of myself in like the 80s wearing G-Shock watches. Cool. On and I'm a guy. I'm a weirdo that wears on my right wrist. And even as a child, I wore the watches on my right wrist. I did some things left-handed, some things right-handed, but that always stuck. I do remember a Tag Heuer Link watch in the mid 90s that I had that I really was enamored with. And then the watch that kind of like really pulled me in was a Seiko Diver, of course, like a lot of us. This is the predecessor to the SKX 007 and 009, the 7001 watch. And this was the one that you had to, you know, it was automatic, but you couldn't wind it through the crown.
You had to shake it. Yeah.
To get it to wind it. So, and I still have that watch. And that's the one that kind of like pulled me into like, oh, I kind of like these things.
Awesome.
That, and, you know, my father had a pocket watch that I was actually married. I got married in about 12 and a half years ago now. I had the insight then of like, if I wear a watch, then I'm locking myself into that watch and having to keep it. So I'm going to wear this pocket watch and not wear a watch on my wrist at all. So that has like kind of the family connection, but that was one of those kind of big old American pocket watches that you could open up the back and see the very simple movement. And that was always a fascinating world to look into. So I was enamored with the technical cool aspect. But it wasn't until that Seiko Diver that I was like, the other side of it kind of clicked in for me of, oh yeah, these are things that like I want to wear and do things in, and I think it's cool. And it opened up the gates, as you know how that goes.
Yeah, for sure. What was the latest pickup? What was the most recent purchase?
An IWC on Ingenieur,
Oh, right.
3289, with the Aqua dial. It's a watch
Amazing.
that I really liked from the moment I saw it, at a preview event in London, last February, and it was one of those immediate, like, this has done really well. I like this. You know, though, when I first said that to somebody and told, you know, somebody at IWC, like, hey, can I put my name down for one of these? You know, the pricing wasn't set in stone quite as yet. So yeah, it's a little steep, I'll give that, but I still liquidated with the watch, and it feels my watch, and the case and bracelet, I think they did an excellent job on. I really love they didn't just bring back the old one, the old Genta design, one to one. I like that they interpreted it in a modern way, and I think that this will allow them to open the door to building a whole new collection on that as a platform, which I hope they do. So there's only two watches that I've wanted to get this year, and I already got them both in January. So that's all the watches that I was really looking for this year.
What was the second one?
The second one was a Rolex Daytona 126500.
Okay, sorry, what dial color is that?
The white, the white.
Okay.
It's okay because the black dial is the exact same reference.
Oh, is it? Okay. All right. I didn't know if, yeah, I guess you didn't have letters at the end, so technically that wouldn't have
I
you
think
know,
they
applied.
classify it as like a dash 001 or 2 or something like that. But yeah, so that was the other one, and that was enough
Nice, man.
as well. So I really like both of those watches, and I feel completely content. This is before Watches and Wonders, though, I'll note. So
Yeah.
subject to change, we'll see.
That's so funny. Yeah. I love that the registers are a little thinner now, you know, back sort of the zenith, you know, zenith days, and I think it's just a little bit more legible for that reason, which is potentially why they did that. I don't know. Do you know why they changed it necessarily, other than just to quote update it?
So I think my feeling is that the proportions of everything was changed around the bezel assembly, which has that ring around the edge. So the bezel itself, the ceramic part, the black ceramic part, got slightly thinner. So I think it was done in a proportional move to the bezel, and then the hour markers themselves also got thinner and longer, which is also like the zenith based. The heavily modified Zenith-based Daytonas of the 90s. And I will say generation was probably a little more photogenic because these elements were older and bigger. They photographed really well. But I do think that in person, the new reference looks cleaner, if it makes sense. So.
Nice. Yeah. No, I definitely support the update. That's for sure. Did you go to Dubai Watch Week?
Yes, I was in Dubai for Dubai Watch Week. I stayed there for 2 weeks, and I went to the final F1 race of the season in Abu Dhabi, the week after, and I did some diving in the Persian Gulf in the meantime, after the show.
Oh, that's right. That's right. Yeah, I remember on your TGN episode, you guys chatted diving. Something I am not involved in, but yeah, that's right. That's right. What was okay? So I've heard Dubai Watch Week's super fun in that it's, and Adrian Barker on Bark and Jack, his YouTube channel covered it like pretty well as well with regards to just, I don't know, like there's like a casuality to it, I guess is the way to say that. It's just a little bit more laid back, I guess, is my interpretation. I've never been. What was your experience like? Had you been before or?
This was my first time in the Middle East, actually. So it was interesting for me for a few in a few ways. Of course, watch events are nothing new to me, so that part of it didn't seem too different. I mean, it's a lot of people that I know. There was definitely kind of a more casual vibe, which I appreciate. Yeah, I try to bring that to wherever I'm going anyways. I don't take myself all that seriously, and So I enjoyed being there. It was a great experience. A lot, the brand lineup is of course really amazing. The hospitality was amazing. And then experiencing Dubai was also really incredible as well. It was I like walkable cities. I like to walk, and that's one of the reasons I love New York so much. I don't have to have a car. I can walk everywhere I need to go, or train everywhere I need to go. Dubai is not a very walkable city. That was my one kind of complaint. However, where it's situated, generally the heat most of the year makes it a tricky city to just want to walk around in for a while. But I feel like I was hoping to like explore the city a lot more, just like on foot, which I wasn't able to do as much as I wanted. But I'd go to the big malls and up to the top of the Burj Khalifa and all that kind of stuff. But then getting down to Abu Dhabi, I feel like that's where a lot more of the local Emirati people live. And then making it to the coast between Abu Dhabi and Dubai was also a very interesting experience, and getting to dive with some people as well. So that's where the city really kind of started to come to life, or the area, I should say, started to really come to life for me a little bit more. But the show itself was very lovely. They do a great job with the show. Shruti does an amazing job organizing it, and I would hope to go back the next time they do it.
Nice. I've actually flown through Abu Dhabi once, and but I've never been to Dubai. What is that commute like? Did you drive or fly between the two?
I drove. Well, actually, had a I got a driver that I paid to drive me between the two. It is it's about 100 kilometers, 110 kilometers, I think. So I guess it's about 70 miles, or something like that. So it took maybe slightly over an hour there and back. So, and then he just waited there for me. I went to the qualifying and then to the race the following day. And yeah, it was a crazy awesome experience. Abu Dhabi is the place that if I was going to go back to probably just spend some more of my time, it would probably be to Abu Dhabi before it would be to Dubai.
Oh, so when you went to the race, you were commuting each day. You didn't go to Abu Dhabi and stay. Wow, that's funny. Wow, that's cool. All right, let's get into the weeds with this deep track thing of yours. I want to talk about why it started. I want to talk about what all is under the umbrella of deep track. I know there's a podcast, we've already mentioned it. You're obviously a journalist. If people haven't figured that out by now, then I don't know what to tell them. So let's could you break it down for us? Like, what exactly is the business as well?
So the deep track, I would say, is it's my avenue to explore the spaces that I'm interested in. I'm a pretty curious guy with quite a few hobbies, from diving to mechanical keyboards, to the watches, to the cars. And I am involved in the communities of each of those spaces. So my goal is to kind of further explore some of these, or the intersection of these spaces and these enthusiast spaces with actual enthusiasts. On the podcast, I've had yourself on. Thank you. You were the first guest on the podcast. And then guys like Matt Farah I've had on, people from the mechanical keyboard world who build them, where we really just kind of nerd out on these things as enthusiasts. And I'm not pitching myself as, I'm the expert and I'm going to tell you how you should be experiencing these hobbies. Like, I'm not in it for that. I'm more curious about how other people experience these hobbies. And I feel like that adds, when I explore that, it adds a lot of depth to how I experience the hobbies. And not only tapping into other knowledge, people that are more knowledgeable than myself, but also the people who get excited about it in different ways than I get excited about it, who they see it in a different way through a different lens. That was what really excites me. They're doing this not as a career, but as something they legitimately enjoy. And it's the same with me. On the weekends, it's not like I clock out and do something else. Like, I'm in these communities and in these spaces talking to people. I'm in the TGN Slack nerding out about F1 and talking diving with people. Just because that's what I have to explore these spaces in further detail through the community, the members of the community, which is what make these spaces so so incredible. And that's, I think they're built on the strength of those communities. And as you know, there are some of these communities you come to it because you like the car or the watch or whatever. Then you stay and you stick around because you make a lot of great friendships and relationships with the people that are inside of it. So the website itself, I like writing, so it's kind of my way to kind of continue writing every single day about watches or about cars. It's usually about watches just because I'm really plugged into that industry. And I like reviewing watches. And I think that's kind of a thing, what I do well, is look at a watch and assess it and talk about it in my own way. So I do that still on the website, and I cover parts of the industry, review watches. I've just launched a YouTube channel that will host some of my thoughts on these watches, as well as my reviews, just like this. So it's really those three things that come together that should kind of paint a picture of what makes some of these places so special. And understanding a better, getting a better understanding of the people within them. Oh, and the drinks, the cocktail thing, like I had a food and wine writer on, that was a lot of fun. So, yeah, it might seem a little strange or unexpected, some of the spaces that I'll go into and talk to people about, but I try to bring the same perspective that I look at watches into these other spaces to understand them. So even if you don't care about mechanical keyboards or cars or something, like I hope I approach it in a way that makes it interesting to our shared like passion for watches.
Yeah. I think it's kind of like when you subscribe to a magazine or, God forbid, a newspaper back in the day, and there's a particular writer in that publication that you gravitate towards, and whatever they may or may not be writing about in that week or that month, it's kind of like, oh, I love Blake Bettner's style of writing, so I'll read about a keyboard. Or I think that's really nice in that sense, where they can just kind of still hear your voice even though the subject changes. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah, I hope so. And it's as long as it's interesting and I approach it in an earnest and curious manner is my goal. And
Sure.
honestly, the episode, the podcast that I did about mechanical keyboards is the second most popular podcast to date. So I clearly there are other people that are curious about this kind of stuff as well. So I hope that I can do it justice.
Yeah. There's like a kinesthetic version of ASMR, I guess. Like there's just like this tactile sense of pleasure, I guess, which is also mechanical watches, right? Starting, stopping a chronograph or clicking a pin, or you know what I mean? Like it's all
Yeah, it
these little.
absolutely is. And like and if I may, just for a moment, the keyboard one of you almost all day, every day. Like this should be a thing that we put a little more thought into than to, well, it's just what the computer came with. Kind of a
Oh,
thing.
100%.
So that's my pitch. Like you use these all the time. Like it should be something that you enjoy and that's comfortable and you can express some creativity through it as well.
I'd make the same argument for shoes. They're on your feet all day. Yeah, I think shoes and a pillow, I think, are the two things that you should invest money in,
People take for
because,
granted, right?
yeah. But yeah, that's great, man. Well, I know you're doing some video stuff too. Can you talk a little bit about that? And like, does your approach change given the written word versus a video?
It does, and I think I can sit down and write 5,000 words about the Daytona. But if I sat in front of a camera and spoke for 30 minutes about some of the minutiae, I don't know if anybody would
Tune in.
to watch
Yeah.
that other than like my mom maybe. So in the videos I don't really get into like breaking down the stats of like, well, this is what movement is in it and this is how big it is in diameter and its thickness, and like it's not about that. I want it to be about something else. And that's where, because you can get that stuff anywhere and there are far better writers than me that can break all that stuff kind of down. So, for me, I talk about it like from my perspective of using it or what I would do with it or why I find it interesting or put it in a historical context that I pay attention to. So for the Daytona, it's really kind of, I was looking at it through the lens of like what Rolex is doing and why I think they're in kind of coming out of a transitionary period right now, and what some of the design decisions that they've been making with some of the new releases say about where I think they might be going in the future and why I think that matters to some of their new releases. So that, it's that kind of a thing that I want to bring to, and again, not as on this stuff, but this is what makes it interesting to me.
Sure.
It's not the the status or the secondhand market pricing or the fancy new movement thing, and it's other things to me, just because I enjoy reading about the history of Rolex and I enjoy engaging with that community there. So here's how that's like the perspective that I bring to looking at some of their newer watches as well. So it has to be about something else, and it has to really tap into what makes it interesting to me personally, and not kind of dwelling on the now, like the hype elements, or here's what I see people talking about on Instagram or anything like that. It has to be, if I find it interesting, I need to be able to articulate that to somebody else.
Yeah, no, and more power to you. I think that makes all the sense in the world. Now, with regards to typing, or writing 5,000 words on a Daytona versus filming something on the Daytona, do you choose or do they coexist? Like, would you write an article and do a video on it, or are you kind of bound to one or the other, and how do you choose what to do for which?
So usually, if I have enough to say about something in a written article, then I can probably do a video on it. And I don't write a script for any of this stuff. I don't have a like it's really just me going, and maybe it comes off that way. Obviously, I don't know, but I want it to feel authentic because this is how I think about it, and not kind of like framed as, all right, here are the bullet points I gotta hit, and here's what people are gonna be. It's more, this is what I feel about this thing, and I want it to come off as this is like I think about this stuff organically, because I do. So the written stuff, that's a very different kind of exercise for me. But if I have enough to say about it, and it's a watch that I find interesting enough that I think enough other people would find interesting, then I want to do it. I just happen to think about, yeah, I mean, I think of a lot of watches for, but I think early days with the video on YouTube, which I'm doing now, I'm trying to kind of capture watches that I feel like there will be more of a search volume for, to kind of build a solid foundation for the channel. So that's why I've been leaning into some of the Rolexes, new and old, just to kind of establish that. And then I'll start to layer in more kind of interesting watches. Not that Rolex watches aren't interesting, but you know what I mean. Like an old weird Zenith watch from the 90s or something like that. Because I also am very passionate about that kind of stuff. My penchant really is for like kind of weird, odd tool watches of like the 90s and early 2000s. Like I own quite a few of those. I think about that kind of stuff. So that will be kind of the next step to getting into some of the weirder stuff that I like and why.
That's great. For the videos, do you hire an editor, or are you doing it yourself, or how are you doing that?
I do it myself, actually. I know editors that have been very helpful to ask questions to. So I use DaVinci Resolve. I actually have a degree in graphic and multimedia design. That's what I went to university for. So I've used a lot of this software before. It's just been a long time. So it's been kind of relearning some of this stuff and then learning DaVinci Resolve completely. And I really enjoy it because it's, you can put a week in or a couple weeks in and kind of learn the basics of it. But I feel like it can take me many years to master any of these things. And I like that about like I like that learning process and journey. So for me, it's all part of the creative process around this stuff.
That's great.
So I enjoy it. So yes, it's me.
How did you land on DaVinci Resolve as a platform?
A lot of the editors that I talk to, I've been reading about them making the switch from Premiere or Final Cut over into DaVinci Resolve, which has, I think, always had the superior like color grading tools. But now, like everything else that it can do, has also kind of taken leaps and bounds. So I think it's one of those things where I did enough research in the community and talked to enough other editors that I felt okay, that will probably be the right route for me to start building on.
Nice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's been great. No regrets.
Now you're on Patreon, yes?
Yes, and I am on Patreon. In starting this, I really wanted this to be like for the community because I consider myself a part of these communities, and I want it to be about creating content. I want my responsibility to be to the community of people who consume the content. Not to ad partners and advertisers. I feel like that can really muddy the waters quite quickly in this realm. So How that will evolve, I'm not quite sure. I feel my feeling is that it will take some time to build up enough trust and enough relationship value with people that consume my content, where they feel like they would want to support me through Patreon or and not, any other big advertiser that that might want to dictate the type of content or the types of watches that I write about or the types of ads that I would have to run before things or in between things. So, I know that will likely make it a slightly longer route, but I think that will make it a more fulfilling and satisfying route for me personally, and hopefully the people that consume the content are the ultimate winners in all of this at the end of the day.
Sure. Yeah. What, so how do you decide what's behind the paywall and what maybe comes for free, or if anything, or you know, is it a one for me, one for you type of thing?
So right at the moment, they get an early look at a lot of the videos being produced. I also do monthly updates on like what is in the middle of production and welcome feedback for people, and even offering them, hey, I've got these kinds of things that I'm thinking about writing. What would you like to see, or what would you like to hear from me about? So at the moment, it's early looks at a lot of the published in production content. So they'll get maybe 4 or 5 days early look at a video. I would like to start doing kind of the deep track shorts, kind of maybe 15 to 20 minute episodes that live just behind the paywall. And my thinking for this is, and you tell me if you think this is a good idea, I want to have like the same like 3 or 4 questions that I start asking like every podcast guest that I have. And then at the end of the month, I compile all their answers into a single episode
Oh, cool.
and then put that behind the paywall, you know? Like maybe silly questions, or maybe not silly, I don't know, but something that would give like a unique insight to that person. And then I think hearing them all back to back could be kind of interesting experience.
I think, yeah, I mean that it's completely cool. It's worth a shot, you know? I mean, I think maybe the best, maybe not the best. I can't say what is the best. My brain went immediately to maybe if you're asking people to pay for said content, perhaps it begins with a crowdsourcing of said questions, meaning what are people willing to pay for? So maybe you send out a message, a bat signal, if you will, that says, what are the types of questions you want to hear so that you're willing to pay for them, as opposed to what's your favorite color?
That's
You
a great
know?
idea. That's a great idea. I like that. I like that a lot. That's a good idea. I think, and I also want to do special episodes. And I was going to talk to you about this actually. Maybe there's like a quarterly type thing we could do, or something that where we talk about F1 and just like
Love
through the
it.
season. And those are just kind of like our bonus podcasts that we have,
Yeah.
where we can just kind of like. Because you and I are both just kind of naturally enthusiastic about it. So I like to think of it as, after the race, we kind of call each other up and like react. There's been enough people that seem to be interested in that kind of a thing.
Sure.
And it's, again, you and I aren't like the technical experts or anything. Like we're just reacting as enthusiasts,
Yeah.
And so I think I want to be that voice for people. So I can see something like that evolving, over time.
Yeah, I think, I mean, obviously you and I both know this, but to those listening, like Blake, you and I have talked about doing this, like kind of sporadically, intermittently over the last few years about how we can come together and do that kind of thing. And I think having that serve as, say, a bonus episode for you, a bonus episode for me, you know, is something that we could both share. And I think that it sounds like a lot of fun. I'm in, you know, I
Yeah,
think
we
it'd
have to
be.
figure this. Let's my people will contact your people. We'll
Yeah.
offline it. We'll
Right.
but I think there could be some. Does it need to be like an episode after every single race? I don't know. Maybe just every few races we kind of jump on and talk about like what's going on over the past few races and react
Yeah.
to them. Or...
Before the summer break, that kind of thing. Yeah, I think it's yeah, it's that's easy. That's a cakewalk. Do you have a white whale guest for your podcast?
there are a few guests that I would like to have on that I think about. I don't want to like jinx anything, but there are some like automotive writers that I like. You've had like Doug DeMuro on, and he'd be a great guy to talk to just because I feel like he's similar to us, just like a just an enthusiast.
Yeah.
And of course now his whole thing has become, huge. But
Right.
there are people in the automotive space, I'll just say that I would love to get on. But boy, anybody, I'm not, but yeah, but like, me, I don't pay attention to like the celebrity culture so much. Yes. So,
Right.
I don't really like care all that much about them. But if there are celebrities that are genuinely interested in this kind of stuff, then like by all means. But I really, it's people that like are a part of a space that I'm almost blind to, but very interested in. Like I had a chef and restaurant owner on the other week, and it was fascinating like talking to him about like just the food scene in New York and how all that works. So it's really people like that that surprise me, that go into spaces that I have very little knowledge of, that I'm just fascinated by, and I just like eat that stuff up. I absolutely.
Yeah.
But yeah, there's no like big celebrities that I would, Brad Pitt and George Clooney to have on and talk about watches. Like, yeah, if they like watches, then yeah, great. But that's what I would want to talk to them about. I want to nerd out on watches with them and not talk about anything else. So.
Yeah, it's funny because like my brain went to Chris Granger and Wilhelm Schmidt. Like those are my two white whales, like or two of them, you know what I mean? Like just
Yeah.
major CEO players in the industry that are also car guys. You know what I mean? Which I guess that's the Standard H podcast, obviously. So
And design guys too.
yes.
Chris himself is also a
Architect.
big
Yeah.
architecture buff and all that kind of stuff, and has a lot of interesting things to say about it. Both really interesting people though, so whatever I can do to help there.
Yeah. We'll talk offline.
All right.
No, that's great, man, and I appreciate it. How has fatherhood changed you?
Oh, I'm a lot more sensitive in some ways, especially like when there's certain movies or books that I read that I find myself almost like getting choked up by, especially now, like as he's becoming like preteen. He's 11, he'll be 12 this year, so he's kind of
Oh,
taking on
wow.
more of the preteen type stuff. So you really get to kind of, you're confronted with your actual like how your responsibility changes with him. And I don't want to hold him back from different experiences, but making sure that he has that I've equipped him well enough with like the right tools to deal with the things that will be going on around him, like how to suss out BS when he hears weird claims or for his friends talk. Like I feel like that's a big thing now, especially as they get more into the internet, and I didn't have to worry about any of this stuff when I was a kid. And but now he has like literally the whole world at his fingertips if he so chooses. So all I can hope for is that like I've taught him well enough how to like see the world through a skeptical lens and ask the right questions, how to ask the right questions, and to be just naturally curious about things. So like seeing how he like takes to new interests has been really fun, and then like making sure that I can be there if he picks up something that I didn't anticipate, maybe I don't even like, but I'm still like there for him to like do it. So it's it there are times when you don't know how you're going to react, and it's really kind of like a not like a rushing into battle type situation, but there are moments I think that you look back on and say that's you really kind of find out who you are when you're presented with certain scenarios, and there's a lot of those in fatherhood. As he gets older, I think they become a little bit more complex.
Okay, I was gonna ask you, like, I mean, with age, does it become easier or more difficult just due to the fact that, like, he's obviously probably got a better sense of communication now than he did at four, you know what I mean? So, like, but also it's conversations can get complex as well as a result. But what is he into, hobby wise?
So he, I mean, he likes, cars. We build Lego stuff together.
Cool.
He really likes football, and he's gotten into like a lot of his friends, or counselors at his school are into Japanese culture, like anime, Pokemon type stuff, which is a very foreign world to me. I don't want to like shut them down on that kind of stuff, but I don't have an understanding or grasp. And it's not like I have to be a part of everything that he does. I want to give him his space that he can enjoy his own things on his own time. And I think that's an important part of growing up with a healthy sense of like who you are. And I want him to have confidence in that. But he definitely, there are some of these things that as a parent you might look at and be like, what the heck is going on? What is that? Who are these kids hanging on? And honestly, like one of my biggest fears is, and I'm sure this is every parent, like as they go into middle school, like the kinds of friendships he'll make, like the other kind of kid to like get in with, and what are they going to be like? And are they going to influence him in weird ways and get him into all these other things? And that's, again, it just goes back to you just hope you've equipped them well enough to, and if you look back at like your own childhood, yeah, I had a lot of stupid things that I was into and stupid people I hung out with and stupid things that I did. And you get through it. So you just got to trust that they will be able to get themselves through. And they have to know, like, through the whole time, the most important thing is that I'm there for them. Like, hey, if you get in the muck or whatever, it's fine. I'm here for you. No judgment. That's like the most important part, I guess. So.
I remember as a kid, like I it was almost a telltale sign that you're into something nefarious if you like you're hanging out with older kids. You know what I mean? Like when you're 13 and your friends are 15, 17, you're probably up to no good as a 13-year-old. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and if he wants to like cause some trouble or whatever, like that's fine. And I always tell him, just don't hurt anybody and don't let anybody else like get hurt around you, and don't damage property, please. If you're gonna do some other things, like I understand if you can get in trouble in these ways, but like those are the things, and like recognize like the types of situations that you get yourself into and be able to extricate yourself from a potentially hairy situation, especially in New York. I feel like that becomes an important thing to know. So, but I think it's going to take that happening to him a few times for him to like really understand it, like anybody. So yeah, it's a fun and beautiful, but very scary.
Well, you're not a tiny little guy. Did you play football when you were a
Yeah, I
kid?
did. I played football in my junior year was the only year that I played. I don't know if I was very good. It took me a while to grow into my coordination, honestly. And I did cross country as well, and I ran, which I really enjoyed, and I still enjoy running as well. But like in cross country in high school, I think my PR was maybe like 20 minutes flat or something like that. 21 minutes, just over 20 minutes, I think. When I was 35, 36, I was running 10Ks in under 40 minutes. And so I was, negative splitting, in faster times than I would do the single 5Ks in high school. So it took me a while to blossom into my coordination. And that's something that I try to hold on to these days. Now that I'm like over the 40 line, it becomes all the more important. But, I'm not racing or anything like that, but just like being active is still, a hugely important part of getting older. Not that I'm old, right?
Right. We're not old.
No.
No. Speak for yourself.
Yeah.
What, so are you still running now? Is that your go-to?
Yeah, I like running a lot. So, especially as like it gets a little bit warmer outside, I'll do the like treadmill and stuff like that. If Jason Heaton is listening, he'd be very disappointed. I don't have like all the hardcore kit that I get out and like run in outside. Like I'll take the lazy route and like hop on a Peloton or get on the treadmill or something. And then, when the weather gets nice, then I'll get out in the park and do a lap or two and that kind of stuff. So.
Yeah, I was going to ask, are you running on the trails or I mean, do you have well, you're in Brooklyn, so you probably have some trails out there, don't
Yeah,
you?
I live very close to Prospect Park, and so they have a like a the road that goes around that the cars can't get into, even though some get into there. But there's a walking lane and some running lanes and some the bike lanes as well. So it's a three, it's like 3.2, it's like just over 5 kilometers around the loop. And so I'll do that, and this, and then on, if I run there from my house and then back, it's like 5 miles in total. So that's a good like solid distance for me to try and do like a few times a week, and then maybe do some lightweight training outside of that, just to, keep the dad bod at bay as best I can. I like
That's
beer
right.
as well.
Well, I was gonna say we're about to talk about some IPAs. Yeah, exactly. So, or I was about to mention IPA. Yeah, it's interesting. I really miss. So when I lived in LA, I did the Nike Run Club, which was out of like the Nike Town store or whatever it was on Wilshire. And that doesn't exist here. Like, there's no Nike Run Club in, you know, San Diego. Well, actually, you know what? The Nike store might still do it, but that's like 30 miles from my house, so I'm not driving 30 miles to go run five.
Yeah, no.
But, you know, I haven't run outside in ages. I'm definitely a treadmill guy when I do. It's just a lot less impact, I feel like, on my knees. But I appreciate the trail too. You know, my wife and I try to hike quite a bit. Like, I mean, not often. Like, we actually probably haven't hiked in a month, but like, it's also been raining here a lot. So,
Yeah, you're in a great location for that. They have like all kinds of different landscape types that you can go explore. I think that's just awesome.
yeah, totally. Well, listen, man, is there anything else you want to talk about or promote, or is there anything deep track related we didn't cover? 'Cause,
Nah, you can. I'm pretty bad at self-promotion, but just go. You can go check out thedeeptrack.com.
perfect.
You can email me at blake@thedeeptrack.com and tell me your ideas, your thoughts, feedback, criticisms. I welcome it all. And then on Instagram, I'm Blake_Bettner, and the deep track is the_deep_track. So give it a follow if you like it. If not,
Sweet.
no hard feelings.
Yeah, amazing. All right. Well, listen, man, I won't keep you any longer. I know you got better things to do.
Nah, man, it's always awesome to talk to you.
Thanks, man. Really appreciate you taking the time. And just let me know if you need anything from me. We'll connect.
All right, appreciate it, dude. Be in touch anytime.
Thanks, Blake.
All right, see you, dude.
Later, buddy. This wraps up this episode of the Standard Age Podcast. If you like what you heard, I'd love it if you'd share it with a friend or two. And if you have a moment, please rate and review the show as it helps others discover these episodes. It absolutely helps far more than you realize. Shout out to Jensen Reed and Super Beautiful for the theme track. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll catch you in the next one. Take care.